We own this country. We own it. And it's not you owning it and not politicians owning it. Politicians are employees of ours. And they're just going to come around and beg for votes every few years, and it's the same old deal. But I just think that it's important that you realize that whether you're Democrat or whether you're a Republican or whether you're Libertarian or whatever, when somebody does not do the job, we've got to let them go.
When your entire culture is under attack, you need the country's number one voice in defense of our American way of life. You need an ally in the fight against tyranny and corruption. You need your weekly dose of Lisa Payne Nager. Missouri Grassroots Radio Network proudly adds our own beauty to America the Beautiful, your own culture vigilante, Ms. Lisa Payne Nager.
Thanks for joining me again here on Wednesday evening. You are listening to Culture Vigilante on Missouri Grassroots Radio. This is Lisa Payne Nager. We are in the middle of a beautiful, I don't know what they call it with this summer here in Missouri. I live in the St. Louis area. We are experiencing the most beautiful weather here, unseasonably cool temperatures here for Missouri during the middle of July, and the summer's half over, so I'm kind of caught off guard. Haven't gotten anything accomplished during the summer that I wanted to accomplish or enjoyed the fun things that I wanted to do here before my kids go back to school. But you know, you can't argue with this weather, and there's no excuse for that to not get it done when you're having beautiful weather like we're having here in Missouri. We are in the hot throes of primary campaign season here in the state of Missouri. Perhaps you are too, where you live. We have a lot, I mean, there are all, you know, all the House seats are up. You know, we have some hotly contested primaries for a House of Representatives. You know, my particular Senate district has a hotly contested Republican primary here, which I will not be voting in that particular race. I will be voting, but not for that particular race. I'll tell you why later. You know, and there are just a number of ballot initiatives on the ballot here in August. And I was kind of thinking, you know, I've had a really difficult time over the summer trying to keep up with things. You know, my life has been particularly busy. You know, I have two kids in college that are home from school, you know, working, trying to do all the things that you're trying to do, keep up with just the daily average stuff. And, you know, we talk here all the time on Culture Vigilante and Missouri Grassroots Radio about trying to engage the voters. And I am guilty of probably what, you know, I've been preaching for so long, trying to get folks engaged and informed, you know. And I have been trying to keep up with the multiple ballot initiatives that are on the ballot this year in August. And I'm confused about some of them. We're going to have a couple of guests on tonight to go over everything that's on the Missouri ballot. Also want to make note that just because we're talking about Missouri ballot initiatives, if you don't live in Missouri, you need to pay attention to this segment tonight, because some of the ballot initiatives that are on our ballot might sound very familiar to you because they've been written by the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. And John Dollarhite's going to come on with us a little bit later on to talk a little bit about that and one of the ballot initiatives in particular, and why it's not good for you here in Missouri and maybe even in your state if this is on your ballot, as if it's, you know, before your legislature, if it's on your ballot as well. But trying to keep up with the fine points of these things, and the politicians have become so adept at writing ballot language now that it's so confusing. You really don't know what you're voting for half the time. You heard me talk about, we have a sheriff's issue here in St. Louis County where they put an initiative on the county ballot in 2012, and we voted away our sheriff's department, so to speak, more or less. You know, right at the last minute, the county council crafted some fabulously worded language, put it on the ballot, and most of the people who are too busy, uninformed, disengaged, didn't take the time to look into the issue closely, and we lost the right to have our elected sheriff run our police force or our law enforcement here in the St. Charles County, Missouri, one of the reddest counties in the state of Missouri, mind you. He lost most of his power. We're going to go to an appointed police chief. it just illustrates so very clearly why folks need to be engaged, why folks need to be informed about what they're voting on. They cannot rely on the ballot language to tell the story. So we're going to have some folks on tonight to talk about all of the initiatives that are on the ballot and why you should or should not support these issues. I'm kind of inclined to vote no straight down the line, but we're going to talk to a couple different people on a couple of different who have different, maybe some a little bit differing opinions on those things. It's just so important, folks. You cannot trust your elected leaders to give you the straight dope on stuff. And when we talk a little bit more about ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, you're going to know why. We're going to give you a background on who those folks are and just how they're driving the agenda here in Missouri and across the state, and some of the other legislation that they've influenced in the past. Just really, really amazing stuff. We've also been talking the last several weeks, and as you know, we've followed this story. Paul Ellison of American Spring 2011 has been following this story religiously for quite some time, and other stories like it. And you've also heard me talk ad nauseum about the judicial branch of our government and how it's selling families down the toilet. The judicial branch has become industry. You know, lawyering and Department of Family Services, and you know, we all watched the Justin Pelletier case with great interest, and just watched how this, I'm not even sure how to describe it, how this mechanism just completely dismantles families and how they make money doing it. We're going to get an update tonight on the Lagares family and their battles to reunite Denny Lagares with his children. I think he's been battling this particular battle for 2 years, and I think the longer battle through the divorce and the modification has even been longer than that, 4 to 6, I think it's 2 to 4 or 4 to 6 years prior to that. So can you imagine what that does, how that destroys parental relationships over the course of that time during those developmental years with kids? Anyway, we'll have the Lagares family on with us a little bit later to talk about all of these things. I did run across an interesting article while I was kind of flipping through looking for current events to discuss tonight. Our own CBS News at KMOV Channel 4 here in St. Louis did an interesting little blurb on the DFS issue yesterday, I believe it was yesterday, yes. Did Missouri DFS lose this child? Local mother says yes. Now, before I read you this blurb, I kind of want you to make note, you know, and you've heard us talk about it here many, many times. And when you followed Justina Pelletier's story and you saw how egregious and how ridiculously blatant and arrogant the system is for families and the disregard of the law that these folks just show, you know, when they come in and they reach their long arm into your family, I'm hoping that this is going to start opening the floodgates on stories, because there's numerous stories about these kinds of issues where the judicial system is selling families up the river, and such departments and agencies like it are just totally dismantling families. Anyway, this and the care which they have disregarded, to the extent with which they have a disregard for best interest of the child. Just keep that in mind. Keep that phrase in mind, best interest of the child, because when the average person hears the phrase, they think best interest of the child. We all in this culture put children above everything. We protect children above everything, you know, and to the extent that these people use kids as human shields to protect their political careers and throw the phrase out, wink you into believing something that is taken care of when it's not. Listen to this and see what you think. This was yesterday. She claims a Missouri Family Services went lost her son. Teresa Radish said her son, Jeremy, 14, has gone missing, and the people responsible for taking care of him do not know where he is. Radish told News 4 her son was with a Susan Knuckles Treatment Facility in Hillsboro, a facility run by Missouri Division of Family Services, or DFS. She said Jeremy had been in the state custody. He had been in state custody to stay out of trouble. Evidently, there were some problems with the family, and DFS stepped in. Whether or not that's completely true, we don't know all the details. She goes to say, I wanted him off the street. That would be best, Radish said. Well, she turned to the government to help her solve problems. That probably was the first mistake. Radish said DFS officials did not contact her until several hours after Jeremy had escaped. They made excuses, said they didn't have my number, Radish said, told me he ran. That's all they could say at the hearing. And DFS officials discussed the case because they said state law information specific to a case or individual. Okay, especially to, you know, to the family. And it, people need to understand these state and government agencies, when they step in and take your kids, you as a parent completely relinquish your rights, to anything that goes on. So this child is gone missing. We don't know where he is. The parents don't know where he is, and they're not telling anybody anything because they don't have to, because they're protected by state statute. The problem is when, you know, when they break state statute, nobody really actually holds them accountable to anything else. And we'll be discussing those kinds of things later on too, when we talk to the Lagares family. Unbelievable. But folks, I mean, you know, we've said before, it happens all over the place. It's happening all over here in Missouri. The Lagareses will attest to that. And it's happening all across the country. The Justina Pelletier case was, you know, the most prominent case, and we keep going back to that, but, you know, there are cases all over the country that are just like that, where these broad assaults on parental rights are just happening every day, and they are not getting the media attention that they deserve, and they are going unnoticed, and parents are being separated from their children. And the best interests of the child, again, are not being adhered to by at least governmental agencies who have taken control of these, of the so-called care and well-being of these kids. It just goes on and on. It's just absolutely amazing. It just goes on and on and on, and it never seems to end. A couple of things that happened this week. I tried to get a hold of Todd Akin this week. Made several attempts through all of my contacts and inside sources and outside sources to get Todd Akin on the program, because he released a book yesterday, and it kind of a tell-all. He's fighting back for the wrong that was done to him during the 2012 election in the primary season and in the general season when Rankins threw him under the bus. Have not received a copy, have not read a copy of his book yet, but Megyn Kelly did an interview with him last night. Maybe it was Monday night, did an interview with him. He has not replied to requests to come on the show. He's been on the show before, didn't have any problem coming on the show when he was campaigning. Would love to have him on the show to talk about his book. I mean, I think this is a pretty friendly interview, a pretty friendly place to interview. The grassroots folks pretty much love Todd Akin, although they were not happy with the turn of events during his campaign season. Everybody pretty much understood having Todd Akin stumble over his words and misspeak over an issue was going to be a much better alternative to having Claire McCaskill in the Senate supporting Barack Obama's policies on Obamacare and everything else. Anyway, Megyn Kelly grilled him pretty good. She let him have it. Held his feet to the fire over what he had said during the campaign, and he made no apologies for what he said. He absolutely misspoke, but evidently there are some issues in his book that are pretty truthful about what he had experienced and what's going on with the establishment Republican Party and how they are treating women, how they threw him under the bus, and what the real agenda is for the establishment Republican Party. So maybe in the future, Todd, if you're listening, you are welcome to come on this show anytime. We'd love to have you back on. You've been on before. We're a friendly interview. The grassroots folks love you out here in Missouri. We'd love to give you your chance to speak your mind. tell us about your book, sell a few copies, and expose some of the things that you know as an insider that we want to, that we as grassroots conservatives want to overturn. We would love to, we'd love to hear from you. So Todd, the invitation is open. Just, you know how to get a hold of me. Oh, let's see, a couple other things. Oh, there was a pretty good article. I posted it on Replace Roy Blunt. There's a Facebook page, Replace Roy Blunt. 10 things Todd Akin really wants to know about, really wants you to know about Roy Blunt. Akin said Blunt isn't Missouri's true conservative. Well, most of us know that if we've been following Roy Blunt for any length of time. On the first weekend after the election, I joined a barnstorming bus tour with all Missouri statewide candidates. We hit all the hot spots. In St. Charles, Missouri, Senator Roy Blunt joined us. He told the crowd, what a great guy I was when we were both in the House. We used to compete to be Missouri's most conservative congressman. According to Blunt, sometimes I won the most conservative, sometimes he did. I'd probably challenge that one. The neck and neck race was news to me, to my staff, and probably his staff too, probably to most of the voters in Missouri. Number two, Blunt was upset after an early general election gaffe. Roy Blunt, who allegedly as conservative as Akin a week earlier in St. Charles, took me to the woodshed. He said if I made another gaffe like that, the state party would not support me, and he was all business after that. Oh, number three, on the day of the legitimate rape story, Roy Blunt called his son Perry Akin, and at that time Todd's campaign manager, and told him ominously, this isn't looking good. Number four, Akin says Roy Blunt is a rhino. We probably all agree with that one. Number five, Akin says Blunt is pragmatic, not principled. Although Blunt and I always had a cordial relationship, he was cool to my candidacy from the beginning. This was surprising because, unsolicited, I had endorsed his Senate race 2 years earlier. During his race, Blunt frequently dropped my name to conservative groups around the state to garner support. Yeah, he was riding his coattails until the winds change. Now when I was running, he was very reserved. I don't know why he was reserved. It may have had something to do with the fact that we represent two different strains of Republicans in Congress. That might be it, Todd. Those who put principles first and those who are pragmatic above all else. Blunt is good at politics, and his first obligation has always been to the party, and I couldn't agree with that statement more. Number six, Akin liked the Tea Party sign making fun of Blunt. Number seven, Akin thinks Roy Blunt is a power player. Number eight, and that he was a bloody war club. Number nine, Akin was upset Blunt wanted him out of the race. And number 10, and thinks Blunt thinks that what Roy giveth, Roy can taketh away. That story is posted up on Politic Mo. I'll have that story up on Missouri Grassroots Coalition. It is up on the Replace Roy Blunt Facebook page. You can join that page, and I'll put it up on Culture Vigilante and Missouri Grassroots Coalition.org Facebook page as well if you want to see that, read the rest of that story. Just some interesting facts there about Roy and Todd and the rest of the group. A lot of other really good. I want to talk about the illegals and the busloads of folks coming into the United States and what that means to you and me here in Missouri and across the country. But I think we're going to stop there because we have a pretty full lineup tonight. I went on a rant last week and ran out of time, and I don't want to do that this week. We've got John Dollarhite with us tonight. John is the Missouri farmer, if you may remember a couple of years ago, who ran into a little issue with the federal government on raising rabbits. You know, funny thing how that works. You know, it worked this way for me. It's worked this way for a lot of people. You just, you know, sometimes you can poke the sleeping bear only so long. And what I mean by poking the sleeping bear, you know, the federal government thinks that they can strong-arm people and scare them, and they'll go away, and they'll run into their cave and hide. They'll submit to whatever the big government wants them to do. Well, people like John Dollarhite and others across the country who have been poked enough, you know, who've just been living their lives, you know, quietly and following the rules, once you step on them enough, you know, it awakens something in some people. And the Dollarhites fought a huge battle a couple of years ago and won against the federal government when they were being fined just inordinate amounts of money. I don't even remember what the final totals were. I think it was $750,000 or something for raising rabbits in their backyard. Anyway, John has gone on. He's kept his foot in the ring. He's still involved and engaged. He's a small-town farmer. And he has really done a lot of work in vetting out all of this information on the Right to Farm Bill here in Missouri. And this may be going on in Missouri, folks, but you, even if you don't live in Missouri, you want to pay attention to this one, because this doesn't originate in Missouri. A lot of the legislation that goes on in your state houses across the country doesn't originate in your state house. And we're going to talk to John Dollarhite next about some of those issues. So stay with us. We're going to take a quick break.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming.
No matter what time of year it is, it's never too early to start preparing for the holidays. And here at Missouri Grassroots Coalition, we're thinking of Christmas now. Why? Because we've set an ambitious goal for ourselves to raise $2,000. That's right, we want to raise $2,000 in 2013 to help some Missouri families who may be struggling in this Obama economy to provide a magical Christmas morning for their children. Last year, in 2012, Missouri Grassroots Coalition touched the lives of 15 families because of the generosity of conservatives across the state who provided us with the means to pay off their layaway accounts on Christmas Eve. This year, we'd like to be able to help twice that number of families, and we're asking you to help us with that goal. Please go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and click on the Secret Santa tab. All the details are there for you to send us what you can by PayPal, check, or money order. We want to thank all who contributed last year for their generosity and hope that you will all help us continue to prove that charitable giving works best in a constitutional republic.
His life so dear, for peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
This is Lisa Payne Nager. You're listening to Culture Vigilante on Missouri Grassroots Radio, and most of tonight is going to be dedicated to ferreting out the good, the bad, and the ugly on our August 5th primary election ballot initiatives going on here in Missouri. Missourians really need to pay attention to this, because I've read the ballot initiatives, and they pretty much all look very innocuous. And, you know, you might as well take a lunch when you go to the polls in August as well, because they're just loaded up with garbage. We've got the Missouri initiatives, and in my county we've got a load of stuff. And then my little municipalities have got a bunch of stuff loaded on. And I'm telling you, I think they do this in August and April because people are busy. Those are low voter turnout times. And they can, you know, the voters that do turn out, you know, have not probably spent a great deal of time researching the issues. And if they can write some pretty ballot language, they're going to just suck you right in. So we've got the folks here tonight on Missouri Grassroots Radio. We're going to go through these major statewide issues and talk to you about them so that you can go and get involved and engaged. And you can share this link with all of your friends so that they, you know, this is a very good place. This is a good one-stop place to shop for all of your information on August 5th ballot initiative language, so that folks can be engaged and knowledgeable when they go to the polls, and encourage folks to go to the polls, because generally also it's very easy for unions and special interest groups to rally their people, to get them to the polls, to vote for their issues, and the special interests are really behind this Right to Farm Bill. We had a puppy initiative here a couple years ago, same thing. And they can get their folks to the polls while the average Joe citizen doesn't bother to come to the polls, so you're outnumbered, folks. I mean, I know we lost our sheriff's initiative here in St. Charles County by like 100 votes during an off-season thing. So, John Dollarheit, how are you?
I'm doing good.
Okay,
glad
you guys,
that you have us on the radio tonight.
I'm so glad to have you on. How are you guys? You're down in the Springfield, the southwest corner of the state somewhere, right?
We are in Nixa, which is 5 miles south of Springfield. We're just kind of a bedroom community of Springfield.
Okay. Are you still raising rabbits?
I am. I have probably about 30 of them right now.
Oh, good for you. How's that going?
And I'm doing good, and I've added to the lineup. I've got about 80 to 100 quail, and I've got, of course, my 30 to 40 chickens that I've always had.
Very good. So tell me, John, let's just give us a real quick synopsis of what happened to you with the rabbit issue.
We received a letter from the USDA, and where it came down to that it was over a two-year period, and so a lot of the reporting that happened was actually just reporting the 1 year of the fine. The actual fine was a total of $6.19 million.
Oh, my God.
And that was to encompass a total of 18 months. There was, but it, so it, you know, it, since it took more than, it was two different years involved there, so they had a, they say that they have a limit of $500 per year of rabbits that can be sold into the pet industry. Well, we had been selling rabbits as meat for quite some time. We were selling some live and some already pre-butchered, but there just wasn't much money into it, and we had already went through all of the steps of what it took to become licensed for meat packaging, because we were actually targeting a restaurant to be able to supply the meat meat to the restaurants. That
sure.
Didn't seem to really ever, that part of the business never really took off. And we were asked by a Silver Dollar City, which is an amusement park down in Branson, to sell rabbits in the pet market, which we didn't know any difference on that. And so we ended up start selling rabbits to them. Changed out all the different, the meat rabbits for more of the floppy-eared rabbits, and that's kind of where it started. And then after we were into it about 2 years, we were actually starting to make a little bit of money on that, doing that. That's when the federal government stepped in and said we had violated their law. We're kind of short and sweet of it. We did fight back. To find that United States Constitution had the 10th Amendment and states' rights. And what that did is that in the state of Missouri, we were not breaking any rules, regulations, laws, ordinances of any kind. So being that we were not selling outside of the state of Missouri, we had not broke any laws. And so it took a long time to try to get people to understand we had not broke any laws in Missouri, and that's, we did not have any help from anybody here in the state of Missouri. It started, came from Rand Paul, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. And then we actually had the only person in Missouri that actually stepped up to us was a Democrat, Claire McCaskill. Don't know why, but she has actually came out and in our defense, mm-hmm. And so that was kind of an odd deal. And then we end up, at the very end of it, we did finally shame U.S. Representative Billy Long to help us out. And he tries to take all the credit, but he didn't do much. And so, you know, basically what it came down to, they dropped the case against us due to no jurisdiction.
Over $6 million, and you had nowhere near the rabbits that you have now at the time,
no,
right?
Well, actually, at one point, we probably had in the area of 300 rabbits, you know, at one point. I mean, by the time that they actually came in and was, you know, started the process with us, we were probably down in the area of 30 to 40 because we were coming into winter. And my wife says we didn't even probably have that many rabbits at the time because we were – we were changing a few things of what we were doing. We were getting ready, coming into the winter. We were keeping the good stock and replacing, you know, going to start replacing it, new stock over the winter time. My wife had a situation where she had to take over her dad's affairs, and so our son had lost interest in kind of it, and had, so there had been a lot of changes by the time that it actually they had came in after us. So, but since that point, you know, we've become very, very political. Kind of one of, I guess my worst situation is I can't keep my mouth shut, and if anything stinks, I tell everybody how bad it stinks.
Good.
So we've taken on with a property rights group and with another preparedness group. If we see something that is in a city council or a county commission that, you know, looks like it's an Agenda 21 issue, anti-farmer, anti-business, anti-liberty, we step up and we tell them our feelings about it, and we do turn around some of the things that get thrown out or thrown at us. We do get support and we get things turned around.
Yeah, you know, sometimes you just got to wonder if the federal, you know, where, what are they thinking? You know, they really do think that they can just bully everybody into submission, but a lot of times these bully tactics just light people's fires and they turn them into lifelong advocates and rebellious big government type of folks and start spreading the word. And, you know, it's not good for their agenda to do that, I would think, so much. I think they would probably do better by laying low and not making people so angry.
Right. And, you know, we're currently, me and my wife are both running for the Republican Central Committee here in Christian County. The RINOs do not want us on there. They have pulled people out of the woodwork that were on the Central Committee 20 years ago to run against me. They really don't want us there because, oh, very much so. The RINOs do not want patriot, constitutional-loving people to be in their country club.
Oh, you betcha. We have that same problem here in my county. And for folks who do not understand what the central committees are, these central committees of your parties, and we're in this case we're talking of the Republican Party, are really the folks, the boots on the ground in your county, who pretty much make all the political decisions and help to shape the platform, help to fill vacancies of key people when that all falls apart, do fundraising and decide where fundraising money goes for things. We give ours away. We can talk about that away. We give ours away to PACs here in St. Charles County. But, you know, there's people on this very local level, elected position, have a lot of influence within the party. So it's really, really important for people like John Dollarheit and patriot-minded folks to think about running for those positions and getting on your central committee. So if you're out there listening, folks, go out and support the Dollarheits for central committee. We need more folks like that in the positions. Thank you for running.
And so on the, what we've started to do, we started to be a little bit, started looking at the amendments, and I never got past for Amendment 1 because I just got so upset with what I was reading. And so I started, once I read the bill, I read the ballot language, and it didn't match up on the Amendment 1 that for right to farm here in Missouri. I started asking questions. And I asked so many questions that I had people in the upper levels of the government that started contacting me. Representative Reibolt from over Neosho is the one that championed the right to farm bill in the House this year. And so he asked for a meeting with us, and we had Kelly Smith from the Missouri Farm Bureau, that he also was part of that meeting. We had a total of 12 people, and there was 10 patriot-minded people that met with the with those two individuals, so they could try to change our mind and try to get us to support the right to farm. So
this right to farm bill. Pull the ballot language up here real quick because it's very, let's just read it so that you kind of understand what it mean, you know, what it's saying. Let's see. First, next general election. Okay, so a constitution of Missouri is amended by adding thereto to the new section to be known as Section 35 to read as follows. That agriculture, which provides food, energy, health benefits, and security, is the foundation and stabilizing force of Missouri's economy. To protect this vital sector of Missouri's economy, the right of farmers and ranchers to engage in farming and ranching practices shall be forever guaranteed in this state, subject to duly authorized powers, I think that's probably key, if any conferred by Article 6 of the Constitution of Missouri. So, you know, if you're just on your way to taking your kids to soccer practice or whatever, and you swing in to vote and you read this and you're not informed about what this really means and you don't know how to read between the lines, I think this can kind of twist you up a little bit. And I also want to get into where did this originate, John, and who's behind this?
Well, when we had our meeting, we had already done quite a bit of research trying to figure out why there were several different states that were looking at right to farm. North Dakota had already passed right to farm. Michigan and Ohio, Indiana and Oklahoma had already died in the House. So what I was trying to figure out is why was the original verbiage of the Missouri bill, why did it match up exactly to North Dakota? And so by doing some research, we found out that all these different states, there's approximately 10 different states that have all had it before them. Some have passed it, some have denied it, and some are up for vote, like Missouri. And we've tried to figure out why. And what we come up with is there is a group in Virginia. It's called ALEC. It is called the American Legislative Exchange Council. You know, and I didn't know much about ALEC, but what I did find is that, like any time that I'd talk to one of our representative and I would ask, hey, could we chant or could you do this bill? Isn't this a great idea? He'd always ask, well, do you have a copy of another state that has already done it? It makes it easier that way.
Right.
Well, what this group in the ALEC does is they are a group of lobbyists and attorneys that they write bills. That's their job, to just sit in. They're a private entity that just writes bills, and they put them in a filing cabinet. And they just keep writing them every day. And so if you run for state rep and you get elected, and you want to do something, so you want to you have something that you want to champion, well, where do you get this? So you can go in as a legislator. You can go to their website. You can go into a search, their search, and type in whatever you want to do: right to farm, abortion, whatever you want
to
run.
Race to the top. To the top is another one.
Yeah, you
and
grab that,
awesome.
And then you champion it.
Prop C, the health care bill. They have originated a lot of so-called liberty-type legislation that really is not so liberty-minded. And maybe the reason for that, as you said, so-called think tanks funded by big businesses across the country and lobbyist organizations, and they pull in their membership from state houses, country. So they state legislators to come in and be members of the organization, and they go to conferences and boondoggles and golf games and hotels and get wined and dined and presented, you know, all of these great ideas every year, to people with huge agendas.
That is correct. And then what we found is that who signed on with to push this across the country with this farm bill was Monsanto and the U.S. Farm Bureau. There's a U.S. Farm Bureau, and then each state has their own Farm Bureau. And then once the Missouri Farm Bureau brought that into Missouri, They actually were looking for a representative that would help champion their the bill they wanted. And they've really been trying to say, well, Monsanto's not supporting it. Well, sure they are. They are one of the on the list of supporters. But mm-hmm. what we ran into is, and they're not hiding this at all. If you go like to Missouri Farmers Care, they will list all the people that are supporting of it. And, you know, that comes down to the soybean board, the wheat board, the corn board, the milk board. And you get into this, you know, large ag, all of their seed comes from where? Monsanto.
Monsanto.
You know, all the feedlots, the feed goes to through Cargill to all the feedlots to feed the cattle, or Arthur Daniels Midland is where all the feed goes through, and all that's going to be GMO food, or all GMO, that is Monsanto is producing. And where we've kind of also tied this to is the Monsanto Protection Act. And by doing that, Monsanto is protecting themselves against lawsuits in the future, just the protection like the government has, so you cannot find them at fault for anything. You cannot take them to court for anything. And so what this amendment, they're trying to do is they are trying to make it Big Ag wants the protection that if they are having to use a Monsanto GMO corn or wheat or soybeans, the farmers also want the protection that Monsanto is getting, since they're the ones that it seems like when anything happens, they always say, well, it's the farmer's fault.
Right. And, I mean, anything can happen.
Right.
To complain about anything. Folks, I don't even know where to begin with. It's so frustrating. And it's complicated. And the average person who's busy raising their kids and trying to get through their jobs every day is not going to do this kind of research and understand. So what does this mean for me? You know, I have my little tomato garden in the backyard. And I'm a homeschool mom, and one of our projects for a year or so was we raised quail. You know, we lived in a place where we could raise quail. And so what happens to folks like us? Maybe.
Well, the way everything I'm finding is that the way that the language that's going to be on the ballot, if it was just that, I would say everybody vote yes for it, because the way the ballot was written, first of all, it uses the word citizens have the right to farm and ranch. So, you know, and with that, it's kind of like, well, that sounds good, and it says cannot be infringed. Well, we all have to vote for that. That sounds great. But when you dig into the bill, they drop the word citizen totally, and they then put in duly authorized powers. Well, mm-hmm. I started asking questions, who are the duly authorized powers? Well, the Constitution does line out who that is in Section 6, I believe it is. The thing is that we run into, that I guess I was happy to see, is that the duly authorized powers were not federal government, which that did make me feel a little better. But what it does is it actually pushes it back more to the local end. So a county or a city can take over your farm with eminent domain way easier with this amendment than what they could have prior. They did have, cities and counties did have some jurisdiction, but it was not as an amendment of the Constitution giving those duly authorized powers. Basically, it gave the local governments more power. So I live very, very close to NHTSA. The city limits is extremely close to me. And if they decide to try to take my land inside of the city, they have an ordinance that says no chickens. And so, you know, I'm very, you know, would not want them to take me in to annex me. So that hits pretty close to home again, that I would have to fight against the city of NHTSA if they wanted to annex us. Now, when you get out into farms, they're not probably going to have as many problems with the right to farm is what people that are closer to town. And a lot of people are complaining about the Humane Society of the United States is behind the running a no campaign against the Amendment 1 also. And I have got to say that they, on this particular issue, they are on the right page, because they're looking at the big corporate farms having protections. Now, I'm looking at it in a different light than they are, but it still comes down to the same issue. The corporate farms will have more protections, but what it also will allow with this, that if the Humane Society does want to come in and to a city or a county, and they get onto a county commission, they could get illegal to farm in the county. So we I was talking about St. Charles County the other day, that, you know, it's, there is a little bit of farmland there, but if you get someone that close enough to St. Louis, that if they somebody from PETA or Humane Society did want to run for, say, a county commission, you know, they could say, with just a vote of the county commission, they could say no farming in that county.
Wow.
So it's easier to shut down farming than if it was left at the state level instead of being brought out to the, you know, to the duly authorized powers.
Okay, there's a couple of points I want to make here. I don't know if you're familiar with Mark Baker of Michigan, I think?
I was getting to my next thing. That was my next comment.
We've had him on the show several times. You know, what a great guy. You know, bravery just abounds, I think. Sometimes you just poke these people and it makes them mad and they get really brave. So he's a small farmer, pig farmer, and his local state government drew up some arbitrary guidelines, but feral pigs weren't, tried to run them out of business. I mean, could that be something that could happen under the provisions here as this bill is worded?
Yeah, I'm sure it could. You get what it was with Mark Baker, and I am friends with Mark. I've been to we went to the Seven Sons farm in Indiana and met him. We had a rally up there. We had a fundraiser for him. And so I have met him, and I've met him a couple other times. We do talk from time to time. I actually called him the other day, and I said, Mark, Michigan has the right to farm. Tell me what they, tell me the good, bad, and the evil, you know, of this. And he says, well, for where he's at, since he's out in the middle of nowhere, Michigan, he says it has not affected him for the right to farm. He says, however, the small farmers that are in closer to town, in the more close, you know, cities and stuff, he says they're being shut down one right after another. He said that the townships are just saying, they're passing rules that no farming is allowed in that township, or no farming is allowed within this county, or this, you know. So he says this is causing the small farmers to be running out of business. Now, for him, he said that so far it has not affected him. However, where this is actually the state of Michigan DNR, and they're using the Invasive Species Act, saying that his hogs are feral. Well, what happened is it was the Michigan Pork Producers Board. They are raising a Smithfield genetically altered pig that is what they're using, and they're saying that what the Pork Board has done is said that if you do not raise a genetically altered Smithfield Foods authorized pig, then you are raising pigs, pigs then are illegal. You're under this DNR. And so they are, they have dropped the case against him currently. However, they are, the hawks are swirling over him again, that they are now, they are trying in another fashion to use, to come after him again. So he's getting ready for round two.
Yeah, it's like the Bundy Ranch, except with pigs all over again, I think. Okay, so my next question is, I think there's a definition issue here, that if it leaves everything up to the state to define the rights of farmers and ranchers to engage, how does that affect somebody like me who likes to grow tomatoes in my backyard? You know, I used to raise quail, you know, my kids and I used to raise quail together as part of our homeschooling, you know, learning process, you know, that kind of thing. Can that be, you know, and I lived in the very rural part of the St. Charles County area, but still, you know, I was kind of, you know, I'm closer into the urban area. So if, you know, all of us who want to grow vegetables in our backyard, and maybe, you know, if we're out far enough to raise chickens or something, and, you know, can they come in and confiscate my gardens or fine me, or can they change those definitions? Who's in charge of setting those standards?
Well, I believe that it can happen, and because what we're finding out is big corporate ag does not like competition. So they want you to they want to control the food supply, so you have to go to them for your food. And
right.
So if this gets put in, I believe that there will be pressure on the local governments to shut down small farms, small, you know, lettuce patches, carrot patches, you know, whatever, tomatoes.
They some of these organic farmers. Sure.
Yes. Because it comes down to this. They want the federal government and now the state government to protect the large agri-farmers. They want the protection that they can now grow Monsanto GMO grains, and they want protection, and they don't want people any competition. They don't want the organic. They do not want the other you know, people growing their own food. So
sure,
I believe
so,
this could happen.
Yeah, when I was growing up, my parents, you know, we lived out farther west of the St. Louis area, western St. Louis County and St. Charles. You know, and at that time, I mean, there was a lot of farmland. We drive to people's farms, and the small local farmers would sell you produce right off their farms. Or some of us enjoy going to farmers markets on the weekends and buying local produce. You know, I live very close to a general store that sells local produce. All of that would maybe theoretically, and it's reasonable to expect that would all go away under this kind of a legislation.
Well, we've also uncovered something else that was quite disturbing to us. When we had our meeting with the Missouri Farm Bureau and Representative Reibolt, I don't know if you have heard, there is a story that's been going around, some advertisements that's been going around about an Andy Clay family that has 3,600 acres on the Missouri River. It's called Jamestown, Missouri. And they have been running, they were even on Huckabee here a week ago or two, and they were telling about how the EPA was coming after them and was fining them $37,500 a day. And, I'm a patriot. I'm ready to do like the Bundy Ranch at this place. You know, I'm ready to call all the you know, people, all my friends and everybody, and we were going to go and we were going to stand guard against the EPA at this farm. Well, it was a fake. It was totally fake. It was a media blitz by the Missouri Farm Bureau to try to make everybody think that this family was being shut down and fined by the EPA. And you can go to the YouTube and just type in the dry ditch. It's called Ditch the Rule on YouTube, and you will see this lady that with three children, and they are farmers, and they will basically say, you know, we don't need any government. It's really a cute little parody that she puts together, but it's an ad campaign. But the way that they've been portraying this, and the Missouri Farm Bureau, once I uncovered this, oh, my gosh, they were so upset that I had figured out that this was not a real case. And so this is just they're going to to all ends to try to deceive the people of Missouri. It's total deception.
Absolutely.
And that out there, because this, I mean, a lot of people have probably seen their ads. for this, and they've made it out there like it was a real situation going on, and it totally wasn't. And it extremely upset us when we were right there in front of the guy from the Farm Bureau. So,
yep.
We learn the further we go.
Yeah, we've seen it in other forms of politics. We watched it with Todd Akin. We watched the media spin on the Bundy Ranch and how they were trying to spin that story to kind of counterbalance the good things that were coming out of there. So it doesn't surprise me at all. Okay, so John Dollarheit, this is an absolutely vote no on this bill. It's the first constitutional amendment number. And out of general principle, folks, whenever you see a constitutional amendment on the ballot, you need to really look at it hard. Amending your constitution, whether it's your state constitution or your federal constitution or even your local county charters, should not be taken lightly. And when you have these kinds of things going on the ballots for you to consider, you need to take a good long look at them. Because, a lot of these things are driven by a much bigger organization. They're not necessarily to benefit the individual. They're mostly driven by people with big dollars who can afford to move an initiative like this. It's a big deal. And so absolutely vote no on Constitutional Amendment Number 1 in Missouri. And if you have this ballot initiative coming across in your state, you need to pay attention to what this is all about, how this could turn around and bite you in the backside. Thank you, John Dollarheit. I really appreciate you coming on. You're welcome to come back later with Tom Martz, and he's going to give us some more information on this issue and the other ballot initiatives. And we really appreciate you fighting. You've done amazing work in ferreting out all the details on this initiative. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for having me on.
Okay, we're going to take a break, folks, and we're going to come back with the Lugaris family, and we're going to talk about the latest developments in their case. So stay right with us. This is Lisa Payne Nager. You're listening to Culture Vigilante on Missouri Grassroots Radio.
Hey, free market capitalist Missouri business owners. Show Missouri and the rest of the country what hardworking, successful entrepreneurship looks like by advertising your business on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Get your message out to liberty-loving citizens who want to support liberty-loving capitalists. Target this unique and widespread market with your business's unique and valuable products and services. Contact us at info@missourigrassrootscoalition.org for details.
And the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
We're back. This is Lisa Payne Nager. You're listening to Culture Vigilante. We're here every Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. Tonight we are ferreting out all the issues on the August primary ballot here in Missouri. But as you just heard, John Dollarheit gave us some great information on why you may be seeing ballot initiatives like this in your state. It's not just happening here in Missouri, so you need to be informed and engaged. And we're going to have Tom Martz on with us a little bit later on to go into some more detail on those things. But first, we have Denny and Sherry Lagaris on the phone with us. We've had them on, and along with Paul Ellison before, to just give us bits and pieces of the ongoing saga of his battle to be reunited with his children. He spent two long years after previous years of custody battles and divorce issues. One thing I want to preface this with, folks, people look at domestic court issues in a very much tainted way. And while they're messy and there's a lot of crazy stuff that goes on in the family court system, people need to engage in this part of your government, because the judiciary has become an industry, the legal system has become an industry, and things are not necessarily happening to the best interest of the kids anymore. It's all about making money. Anyway, we have Danny and Ginger. I was Danny on the show.
Hello?
Hello, is this Ginger?
Yes.
Hi, Ginger. Thank you. Are you and Denny on the same line?
Yes, we are.
Okay, good. Okay, Ginger, first of all, I'm going to talk to Denny tonight, too, but I want to, I got a message today. You guys have been fighting this battle for a long time. I know Denny has been representing himself pro se, trying to get this thing moved forward. Fabulous, outstanding job presenting evidence, presenting facts, and the judge kind of keeps kicking the can down the road. And he was recently back in court, and the judge pretty much told him, get a lawyer or we're not doing anything. So he's being forced into hiring a lawyer. And you have started an initiative, a GoFundMe initiative, to help with legal expenses. You want to talk a little bit about that as we start off this evening?
Yes, I did start a fundraiser through GoFundMe.com. The fundraiser is to help with the legal fees that we both are, you know, going through. And obviously, neither one of us have attorneys. It's definitely been a huge mess, and I know the attorneys that we have spoke to, because obviously we don't want any local attorneys for obvious apparent reasons. And the attorneys that we have spoke to, you know, their starting out cost is around $20,000 just to get started on both of our cases. And mostly, mainly because of his case being such a high-profile case.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to take the initiative to figure out what we could do, because obviously we're not going to be able to get Kyle and Nicole home if we don't have, if he doesn't have an attorney. I mean, that's what the judge told him. So, you know, hopefully if we can get an attorney, a good attorney that's from out of town, then hopefully we can get Kyle and Nicole home sooner. You know, hopefully we can get all of this done and over with and get into trial and get the evidence out and, you know, get it done and over with so we can have our lives back and we can be a happy family once again.
Just, you know, the business of your own kids, you know, and keep data. Okay, so let me just ask a question, because I'm not sure what the answer is. Okay. Do people have the right to represent themselves if they court law?
I'm sorry, Lisa, you're cutting out. I couldn't hear all of that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we are getting screwy connections here on my end as well. I'm not really sure of the answer to this question, but do people or do they not have the right to represent themselves in a court of law if they choose to do so?
You would think that we would, yeah.
Okay, but basically what's happening here, after 2 years of stonewalling, the judge that has had Denny's case basically told him, don't come back to my courtroom without an attorney?
Basically, yes. He was going to have another court date sometime this month. I don't remember when it was. And the judge ended up just telling him, you know, hey, call me and let me know if you have an attorney first. We, you know, basically there's nothing that he's going to do until he has an attorney, which definitely is not legal.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Doesn't this raise a constitutional reg? Aren't there some problems here with this behavior?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So let's talk about this GoFundMe thing, because I want people to be able to understand where to go in order to help. I'm going to post this link on the Culture Vigilante Facebook page so that you can go there and read about this. Ginger Lagares started this. She's got 314 friends, I think, on Facebook that have done it. The goal is to reach $10,000, and you just started it, right? You just got this up and running a day or so ago.
I've been working on it the last 2 days, and I just made it public today.
Okay. Okay. So, I mean, I people just need to understand, when you are up against the wall, and you just heard the story of John Dollarhite and his rabbits, where they were, the federal government was trying to fine him more than $6 million to, you know, be able to main, you know, to fight back, you know, to raise rabbits on his little farm. And people that are fighting in their local family court systems spend tens of thousands of dollars as a matter of rule in courts where nobody's watching. Judges are not making sure that these cases, you know, are being handled in a timely manner. Attorneys are billing, you know, billing by the hour. Every time they answer an email, read an email, or answer the telephone, they're billing you. And you, to just to walk into their offices and take your retainer, they want $10,000, $20,000. Imagine writing a check for $20,000 just as your first retainer. And then these cases often go on for years. Years. There have been more than one documented story of families losing their entire life savings trying to get their kids back from these systems. And up until this point, the reason that the Ligarises have been, you know, representing themselves in public or representing themselves in court was to try to fight back against this kind of highway robbery. So you can, let's see, you can go to GoFundMe.com/BF4ROK. You can read about the Ligarises family and donate there to this cause to help the Ligarises fight this issue. And hopefully, you know, the next step, what I would hope to see is that we bring some attention to the judge and his behavior, because it's this.
I'm here. I'm cutting out still again. Sorry.
Okay.
Definitely. Every donation would be greatly appreciated. You know, every little bit is going to help in our battle that we're having to deal with. You are completely right when you speak about the legal fees. I mean, these legal fees can run from $60,000 to $100,000, and we've been told that with Dennis's case, it's not going to be cheap. He's already spent, I think last time we tallied it up was $70,000 or so, and that was just within the last 4 years.
What is Denny's profession? What does he do for a living?
I'm sorry, do what?
What's Denny's profession? What does he do for a living?
We are self-employed. We own our own business doing asphalt and seal coating and parking lot work, stuff like that.
Okay, so you guys aren't trust fund babies. You know, you don't have a slush fund, to be able to drop $100,000, you know, fighting court battles. This is going to be financially devastating to your family.
It definitely is financially devastating. It just makes it, I don't know, it's not realistic for normal people. You know, it's not like we own Walmart or something and, you know, hand out $100,000 to a lawyer and say, you know, here, take care of this for me.
Right.
It's unrealistic.
Absolutely. Okay, is Denny on the line with you? Because I kind of like to ask a couple questions about what he's been dealing with past.
Yeah, I'm here, Lisa.
Hi, Denny. Thanks for joining me
Hi.
Tonight. I mean, I've gotten some bits and pieces about what's been going on with you the last go round. We with the judge after you still have not received a hearing in front of a judge in order to try to get this visitation of 1 hour a week with your kids taken away, for which is completely they have absolutely no evidence to be doing this to you in the first place. Kind of give me the rundown on what's going on here.
Well, what's going on is, like you said, they gave me supervised visits in October 31st of 2013, which was my birthday. And that was I think that's about the worst birthday present I've ever received in my entire life.
Yeah.
But I got that, And you're right, there has not been any due process hearing whatsoever. The Division of Family Services, I've had supervisors for 9 months. The Division of Family Services actually filed a motion saying that the orders that were placed in effect for the supervised visits are illegal, and they made no recommendations prior, and they made no recommendations after that supervised order came down. And so basically they want out of the case, and they want done with it. Well, we've got a new judge, and the new judge did an informal conference, and he didn't really address the motion from Division of Family Services. Their attorney showed up last Monday, and they basically nothing really happened last Monday. He reiterated that, you know, I should get an attorney and stuff like that. And I said, well, let's reconvene on Wednesday. So last Wednesday we reconvened in another informal conference. And, you know, I put the argument forth that Division of Family Services says these orders are illegal. I say these orders are illegal. They need to be, you know, I didn't get due process. Division of Family Services says they didn't get due process. You know, so these orders are no good. And the judge said, well, I want to move forward with this case. I want to get you a little more time with your children, stuff like that. And, you know, and I told the judge, I said, Your Honor, I said, the only way to move forward is to stop violating my rights. I didn't get due process. You know, we should rescind these orders and make them void because they are void. And he actually counted it out how many times he said that I should get an attorney. And yeah, I think it was like 15 or something like that. Basically, you know, like Ginger was saying about the attorney thing, you know, I needed to get an attorney to move this case forward. And, you know, like I argued about, you know, not having these go forward. And they, he just basically said, you know, like Ginger said, well, call me in 2 weeks and let me know if you got an attorney so we can move forward. And, so then we got into the supervised visits, and I asked for protection against the mother's, my ex-wife's boyfriend, or husband, or whatever. I'm not 100% sure they're married or whatever now. But they basically kind of said, you know, they never really addressed that issue. And I told them, I said, he doesn't need to be there. He's, you know, attacked me verbally at these things before I go in, after I come out. And then, you know, and nobody really addressed that. And I said, well, you know, there's no reason for him to be there. And I only get 1 hour a week with my children. And, you know, to have it like that, that's just not right. And it's not in the kid's best interest. And that was one of my other arguments about the supervised visits themselves. I don't know if anybody's ever seen where they have these supervised visits, but it is no different than being in a jail, you know, in their interrogation rooms. There's no difference. I mean, somebody sits there and watches you through the window. Go ahead.
Kids in this environment every week. Why would they take little kids? I mean, your kids are young. Huh? Why would they bring little kids into this environment every week for an hour? You know, and I just kind of want to backtrack a little bit, Denny. What were the allegations that caused them to take kids away from you in the first place?
That's where it gets a little complicated. Division of Family Services says that at first, they wrote an email to the judge and said that I emotionally traumatized the children because I took them to the emergency room in the police station because the kids came back with bruising and stuff. And I took them there to seek medical care and to document that these bruises were not with me. You know, I just got
so
them back.
Regardless of whether or not the kids needed the medical care is not the debate. The fact that you sought medical care for your kids is a reason for them to take your kids away?
Right. And actually, Division of Family Services told me that if I did not have faith in their department, which prior Division of Family Services in my divorce case was, it was proven on the stand that they did not follow protocol. And so they told me, the lady that actually did not follow protocol is actually the supervisor supervising my stuff right now, but she actually said that if I don't have faith in their department, that I can take them to the police or something like that. And then now they're punishing me for that, that I did that. And then 2 months after I got the supervised visits, I have an audio recording of the Division of Family Services, and I talked to them after one of my supervised visits, and I asked them, I said, you know, what evidence do you guys have to take my children from me? And they said, well, what evidence do we need? And I just told her, you know, any would be nice.
And you've spent the last 2 years trying to get that particular item in front of a judge so that somebody
right.
could determine whether or not you have abused your children.
Exactly. And then later in that conversation, I asked her, I said, why do I have supervised visits? And she said, because I cannot get along with the mother's boyfriend.
And that's all of a sudden required for you to be a good parent to your kids is for you to get along with the mother's boyfriend. Okay.
Right. And that's why I have supervised visits.
Okay. All right. This, folks, is the reason why you need cameras in courtrooms. This is the reason why we need to stop allowing the judicial system and the legal system to operate under a veil of darkness. Because this is the kind of stuff that goes on every day. I mean, it's been happening to the Legarrette family for 2 years, and I can tell you it's been happening to a lot of other families as well. I've heard stories like this, just countless stories like this from other people on very similar, very closely related issues. So, Denny, so do you have a lawyer?
No, I do not. I'm still representing myself pro se. But I am in search of one, and like Ginger said, a good one that's mm-hmm. that's going to, help us and, bring these problems to light and correct them. And like Ginger said, an attorney, we've talked to a couple of them. And they want anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000 just to start our cases as a retainer.
Right. As a retainer. And to be replenished as they see fit to spend your money, pretty much. You have pretty much no control over how the money is spent after that, how much time they spend looking at whatever, doing whatever. I mean, they just kind of dip into that retainer as they see fit.
Right. And, there are good attorneys out there that actually help people and have a conscience, but they are few and far between,
Right. And part of the problem is you can't get a local attorney because those local attorneys have relationships with the judges, and they don't want to ruin their relationships with the judges in their county because they have to go against, before that judge on other unrelated cases, and they don't want to tick them off.
Well, and that's exactly what we've been told by some of the attorneys around here, the local attorneys that we've talked to, is that they have other cases to think about and other clients, and they just cannot take this case because it is such a high-profile case that it would damage their other clients.
Absolutely. Okay. Denny and Ginger Legarrette. Go ahead.
Oh, one more thing I was wanting to say. Division of Family Services actually, they wanted, well, not really Division of Family Services, but these caseworkers themselves here are wanting to make the medical decisions for the children, but they say they're not a party to the case, but they want to make the medical decisions for the children on whether they go to the doctor or not, which my daughter has a history of medical issues and that she needed to be seen for. And I asked them to have her mother take her to the doctor because she was sick and the symptoms of her medical condition was showing to light. And the caseworker said, well, she didn't think that she needed to go to the doctor. And so, I mean, that's the type of stuff that I'm dealing with, is not even being able to get the children home and keep them safe and stuff. Not only that, but the part of actually trying to get my daughter the help that she needs, as well as my son, with his therapies and things like that that have been recommended by doctors that his mother just refuses to take him to.
Basic parenting decisions that on every day that the government has climbed in and taken control. Okay. Denny and Ginger Lagares, I'm going to post this link to your GoFundMe site on Culture Vigilante Facebook page. And you need to go there, drop a little money into that fund. You guys will come back on with me, I'm sure, and keep me updated as things go on. We want to hear when you get an attorney, see if there's anything that we can do to help you keep this out in the open and shine a little light on this issue, I hope.
Yes, we will. And Lisa, we very much greatly appreciate you having us on our show and allowing this to be brought to, and thank you for posting that on your Facebook page as well.
You're very welcome. Let me tell you, folks, I mean, you've heard about this case for quite some time. You know, it's been going on for quite a while. But until you've actually been through it, it is one of the most frightening things in the world when somebody, you know, City Hall is big. Big government is big. And when they're fighting you, the little guy, and they're trying to take the most valued thing in the world from you, your kids, you have no idea how intimidating that is. And how scary that is to fight. So the Lagares family, very brave for making these decisions, standing up, bringing this out into the open. Not only are we hopefully helping you, your family, and your kids, we'll be helping other families as well by bringing this issue out into the light. Thanks for fighting so hard.
Thank you, Lisa. And you're absolutely right. Us being able to bring this stuff to light and make the strides that we will be able to make will help other families and hopefully keep them from having to go through the same trauma that our family has gone through.
Absolutely. Okay, stay in touch. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you again very soon.
Thank you, Lisa.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We are going to come back with Tom Martz, and we're going to talk about the rest of these nasty little ballot initiatives. Stay with me. Lisa Payne Nager, Culture Vigilante.
It really is time for the people of America to take up pitchforks.
Have you joined Missouri Grassroots Coalition yet? The results of the 2012 election proved that the grassroots conservatives need to work harder to make their voices heard in government. The best way for Missouri conservatives to make their voices heard is to join together within the Missouri Grassroots Coalition Network and show our elected that we are a strong, unified, conservative voice in Missouri. Go to the website, MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, and click on the Join tab. Give us your contact information so that we can keep you updated on the latest developments in Jefferson City and beyond. Also, sign up for Grassfire Alerts so that you can get immediate notifications when we need to call grassroots conservatives together in action. Use the MGC network to help your grassroots organization speak with a louder voice, combined with grassroots groups across the state. Together, we can strengthen the conservative voice in Missouri.
Our well-being at home and our leadership abroad are inextricably linked. Our friends and allies must again be able to trust us. From Israel to Colombia, from Poland to the Philippines, our allies and friends have to know that we will be reliable and consistent and determined. And our foes can have no reason to doubt our resolve, because peace really does come through strength.
Just when you thought it was all over, when you thought it was time to hang it all up, Lisa is back.
We're going to be talking to Tom March from the Locke & Smith Foundation. He's got all the latest information and news on all the ballot initiatives that are coming up on the August 5th ballot here in Missouri. And I'm guessing, because I know Tom, I'm guessing he's going to tell me to vote a straight no ticket. Is that Tom?
Actually, no.
Really? I'm wrong. Okay. All right.
Yeah, you're actually wrong on one.
Okay. Let me know. So I'm assuming talked to Dollarhite earlier on the program. He gave us all the lowdown on where this right to farm bill was coming from and who's behind it and why we should not vote for it. I'm guessing we're clear on that one. What have we got going with some of these? Do you add anything to the right to farm debate, or should we move on to constitutional amendment number 5?
Well, one thing about Amendment 1 is why I can tell you for a positive fact on August the 6th that regardless of which way the people vote, the farmers will still be farming, just like they have for hundreds of years.
Okay, but what about the little guy? Me, my little, raising my chickens and my quail and my tomatoes, what about that?
Well, for right now, they'll still be doing those things, too, until government decides that they're going to start enforcing rules and regulations upon you because you're not a farmer.
Yeah, because they can, because we've just changed the Constitution, right?
Well, sadly, they can right now. I mean, I live in a city right now that decided that they needed to give me permission so I could have chickens.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I can have chickens with or without their permission. Now, if I decided to do it without permission, then I subject myself to basically what the people that were on before me are going through, and that would be the judicial system.
Uh-huh. Okay, so let's kind of qualify this. Okay, so I live in St. Charles County. I'm kind of, St. Charles County is a very developing county, but there's still a lot of rural farmland, so I'm kind of, I literally live across the street from a horse barn, a horse stable. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, literally, across the street from a horse stable. And, there's cornfields less than a quarter of a mile as the crow flies from my house. And, there's a lady that raises chickens, a mile and a half. If I wanted to go buy, free-range eggs, I could do it. But I can't raise chickens in my backyard because I actually live in a subdivision, that's been subdivided, and I live with other neighbors and stuff, and I can't raise chickens in my neighborhood, and actually I'm not really sure that I would want to live in this neighborhood and where people could raise chickens. I'm not sure that's the best thing where I live. They told me I can't do it. I really don't have too much of a problem with that, to be honest with you. I think it's our neighborhood covenants that do that. I'm not sure how far it goes in our county government, but I think that there are reasons for people not to be able to raise chickens everywhere. But I am a little concerned that I can't have my tomato plants. I mean, it's a public health issue.
Yeah, and I think I was in a meeting with the sponsor of that piece of legislation, and the gentleman who heads up the Missouri Farm Bureau for that piece of legislation, and they seem to think that it's no issue, but if our government operated in the capacity that it's supposed to operate, Article 1, Section 2 should shut down everything in regards to government telling you what you can and cannot do. But nobody listens to it. They all ignore it. The reason that's important? Because we're getting ready to put Article 1, Section 35 in the Constitution. If they've ignored the other 34, what makes anyone think that they're going to pay attention to number 35?
Of the Missouri Constitution.
I mean, we've got a document that basically limits government, tells government what you can and cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
And every single right that we have within the Missouri Constitution has been trampled on by the courts, the legislature, and local governments.
Yeah.
So for anyone to think that Article 35 or Section 35 of Article 1 is going to give farmers or ranchers any protections, I've got swampland here in Missouri to sell you dirt cheap.
So you think it's kind of a waste of time? They're not really.
Oh, it's a huge waste of time.
So, okay. So it just creates more business for the courts, basically.
Yeah, and it also points out to local governments. And this is the part about this bill that absolutely infuriates me and irritates me probably the most. It literally points out to local governments, hey, by the way, just in case you didn't know that you have this power, we're going to put it in the Constitution to let you know that you absolutely have this power.
Okay. So there's a bit of Yankee Doodle going on here. It really doesn't mean much. Somebody's either campaigning, soliciting campaign donations by okay. So, and, you know, that brings up a great point, that now that you kind of point that out, and I kind of had this discussion with Dave, too, about the gun thing. And you see this, I'm sure, because you guys do such a great job of picking out the legislation, every legislative session, right, more than 2,000 pieces of legislation, every session, you know, that they're in session. And a lot of it is just writing legislation to either Yankee Doodle prop up statutes and constitutional articles that we already have for campaign purposes or whatever. It's good FaceTime. And it means absolutely nothing. So, I mean, is that where we're going with this? We've already got it's kind of like, you know, enforce the border laws. We've already got good border laws. We don't need to be, you know, bringing immigration reform, because we already have reform. It's not replace, it's reform. So, is that what we're doing here? Does that make any sense?
I believe so, because farmers have been farming for hundreds of years.
Do you think that somebody's going to redefine the definition of what a farmer is and who is a farmer? So
I think once it gets into the court system, somebody's going to have to define it.
Okay.
First time
it gets challenged.
If you look at the legal definition of what a farmer is,
mm-hmm.
in all sincerity, I could qualify with my little backyard garden and my backyard chickens.
Mm-hmm.
I could qualify to be a farmer because I can produce up over $1,000 worth of products that I could sell should I choose to sell.
Right.
Now, is the city of Springfield going to allow me to get away with calling myself a farmer?
It kind
maybe
of depends
not.
If they want. Maybe not. It depends on where the political winds are blowing.
Right.
You just don't know.
You don't.
Okay. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to vote no on that one for sure. Let's talk about Constitutional Amendment Number 5. Shall the Missouri Constitution be amended to include a declaration that the right to keep and bear arms is an unalienable right, and the state government is obligated to uphold that right? That's the ballot language.
I actually like the fact that they're removing the stupidity that you can keep and bear, but you can't do so behind your shirt. I mean, Article 1, Section 23, for the longest time, has bugged me. How can you have the right to keep and bear, but you can't keep and bear concealed without a permit? I mean, the whole way that thing is worded is an oxymoron. Now, the fact that they're putting in the strict scrutiny and they're placing mental disabilities and mental deficiencies within the Constitution, that part needs to be removed, because I just have this vision of post-traumatic stress disorder, you know,
mm-hmm.
and
they're
going to
define what that is.
Right. If it's an unalienable right, then that means government can't regulate it. But then you tell me it's unalienable, but if I have what you deem a mental illness and a court agrees with it, then I don't have that unalienable right. You can't have it both ways.
Yeah, so it's unalienable except when it's not.
Correct.
Okay. So is it a yes or no? Because, you know, basically what this does, when I read this, I played the Yankee Doodle song. Because this to me, and I had this debate with Dave, and I'm not sure where I stand on it. Maybe to me looks like Yankee Doodle, because don't have the unalienable right to keep and bear arms, concealed or unconcealed, via the Senate. And the argument, I think, is for the Constitutional Amendment number 5 folks, is that since the federal government has already, like you said, trampled on all of our Second Amendment rights to begin with, they're making federal laws regulating how many military permit, all these things. What makes this bill kind of helps to strengthen the State Sovereignty Act part of it? Is that true? Is it not true? What do you think?
Well, see, I'm not even talking to federal government. I'm talking to state government. It wasn't that long ago that the city of Lake Ozarks passed a law prohibiting open carry within the city limits of Lake Ozarks, and they used Article 6 of the Constitution, which is local governments, to do so. Now, they forgot the verbiage within there where it says not repugnant to the Constitution, but there are a handful of cities throughout the state of Missouri that have bans on you carrying firearms within the city limits. How did that happen?
So how can
I have
how
the
can
right to keep and bear according to Article 1, Section 23?
Yeah, but doesn't 2A supersede Article 1, Section 23?
Doesn't what?
Doesn't Second Amendment of the federal Constitution supersede anything that happens on a state or local level?
No, I don't believe it does.
Why?
Because the states made the federal government, not the opposite way around.
Yeah, but it's the Constitution of the United States.
Well, that's true, but I'm not a citizen of the United States. I'm a citizen of the state of Missouri.
Okay.
And my rights, in all sincerity, since they are derived from God, are superior to either Constitution. Your only job as a state representative or a state senator is to defend my rights. You don't get to define them for me. You don't get to tell me the ones that I have and the ones that I don't have. You get to defend my rights. The only time you get to take my rights away from me is if I infringe on someone else's rights.
Mm-hmm.
And by opening carry in the city of Lake Ozarks, I'm not infringing on anyone's rights. You may not like that I have a firearm on my side, but I'm not infringing on your rights whatsoever.
Right.
So I want to know why it is that these cities can get away with trampling on my Missouri guaranteed right within the Constitution to keep and bear a firearm any place, anytime, anywhere I go, but yet there are a bunch of cities throughout the state that have passed laws to say, no, you can't do that. Where's our elected officials going, wait a minute, you can't pass those kind of laws. The way the Constitution is worded right now, you can't pass those kind of laws. But you don't hear anything, not a peep.
Okay.
And it is the state of Missouri who's trampling on our rights as per the Missouri Constitution. I could care less about the federal government.
Okay, but the federal government, the United States Constitution, does supersede anything that goes on in the states, does it not? Or am I wrong there?
No, I don't. As long as the federal government is contained within the U.S. Constitution, I will agree with you, yes.
Okay, and the Second Amendment is pretty basic.
Second Amendment is pretty basic.
So
shall not be infringed.
Shall not be infringed. I can carry, I can own, I can conceal, I can do whatever I want concerning firearms. It doesn't state whether or not I, you know, am crazy or, sane, doesn't, I can do it.
Correct.
So why would something in the Missouri Constitution be able to make that null and void, saying whether or not I have a mental disorder or, you know, whether, you know, like certain cities can do it in whatever. I don't know why I need this, because this seems to me like the Second Amendment is pretty basic, covers it all. Why do we need this?
I may regret about what I'm about ready to say, and if okay. I do, I do. But I think this all goes back to the Second Amendment Preservation Act.
Okay.
How can we appease those people who worked so hard, Preservation Act passed, when in reality you didn't really work hard to pass the Second Amendment Preservation Act? Now, I know there are individuals who did. The problem is the legislature didn't. They kept loading it up with revised statutes for the state of Missouri, knowing full well those two things can't be in the same bill together.
Yeah, I didn't want it passed, basically, because Doug Funderburk really threw a wrench into those works, I think, to make sure it didn't pass.
I think it's to pay off those people who worked so hard to try to get the Second Amendment Preservation Act passed. Personally, I don't like the rewrite of Article 1, Section 23.
Okay.
And neither did the legislative committee.
And you're voting no on this one.
I'm voting no on one, and I'm voting no on three or five or whatever it is, the one you're just now reading.
Constitutional Amendment 5.
Yeah, Amendment 1 and Amendment 5 for the Legislative Committee and Lock and Smith Foundation are no-goes.
I think for different reasons.
Yeah, we're looking at this purely on a constitutional aspect. We're not trying to bring in arguments that don't exist or arguments that may exist in the future, but they're just not there yet.
Okay.
I don't need a rewrite of Article 1, Section 23. I do. I need you to remove this section that talks about concealed carry permits, and I need you to somehow, the legislature needs to tell these towns who keep passing these laws that infringe upon my right, you need to take that law off the books. You don't have that authority. You're violating the Constitution.
Yeah, of Missouri and the federal United States Constitution.
Correct.
Right. Okay. I'm voting no on those as well. Okay. Constitutional Amendment 7. Should the state of Missouri Constitution change to enact a temporary sales tax? Is a temporary sales tax? What am I thinking? Should the state Constitution be changed to temporary sales tax of 0.75% to be used solely to fund state and local highways, roads, bridges, and transportation projects for 10 years, with priority given to repairing unsafe roads and bridges. The change is expected to produce $480 million annually to the state's transportation budget and job creation fund, and $54 million for local governments. Okay, what do you think? I mean, I already know.
I'm voting no on that, and I'm a huge advocate of sales tax funding the proper function of the government.
Yes,
I would have almost thought of accepting or of actually saying yes to this if they would have repealed the fuel tax.
Okay, and that was the big debate, because they didn't repeal the fuel tax.
But as for that, I'm getting tired of the argument that, well, it's a sales tax and there are people who don't buy cars, therefore they don't use the nation's highway system. Well, how did that food get to the store shelf that they went down and picked up?
Right. We all pay for the infrastructure because we all benefit by the infrastructure in one way or another.
Correct.
Yes. But we also know that there is no such thing as a temporary tax.
Correct.
Money that never got. So that's a no-brainer. Constitutional Amendment number 7 is no. Okay. Constitutional Amendment, and to use that revenue from the sales of these tickets for products and services related to veterans. The annual cost, unknown, but likely minimal. What do you think?
Well, let's substitute veteran for any other profession. Let's say nurse, doctor, police, firefighter. Let's say police fire pension fund. Let's say I mean, I could go on and on and on and on and on.
Are we creating a protected class?
Well, I think we are, and I think that also actually violates, in all sincerity, violates Article 1, Section 2 of the state of Missouri, where it specifically states that all people are to be treated equal under the law. So you are setting aside, and as a veteran, I hate to say this, but looking at this from the constitutional perspective, you know, you're creating a special class of people by having a ticket specifically for veterans.
Mm-hmm. Not to say we don't. It's not to say that we don't support the veterans, and I do believe that the government should fund veterans' issues. I mean, you know, that's part of the deal. That's part of the job of the government to take care of those veterans. But I just don't think that this is the way to do it.
You know, part of the problem we have as a nation is we do not think about the cost of the people who return from these stupid wars that we get ourselves into.
Well, right. We fight. We don't fight them, win them, and get them the hell out. We waste a lot of valuable resources, time, money, and lives. And perhaps if we were serious about protecting the country in the way that we needed to, on occasions that we need to, we would be more expeditious in the way we're handling things. It might be a different situation.
Oh yeah, and they never think about the consequences or the cost of when these people start returning, the millions and millions and millions, and I don't disregard the fact that they need those millions and millions and millions, but had the people thought about that beforehand, maybe the thought process would have been a little bit stricter in whether or not we were going to send troops overseas.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Constitutional amendment number. So far we're voting no on everything, so this must be the one you're voting yes on. Shall the Constitution be amended so that the people shall be secure in their electronic communications and data from unreasonable searches and seizures as they are now likewise secure in their persons, homes, paperbacks? Well, we're not secure because the NSA is listening to us right now. What do you think? I don't understand why we need this one. And tell me why this one isn't Yankee Doodle. Why is our electronic data not considered part of our personal whatever already?
See, now this one right here is going to answer the question of whether or not Tom rules the legislative committee or Tom is a member of the legislative committee. I personally agree with you, Lisa. However, the legislative committee, when we looked at this, the term amend means to clarify or to make something that's in existence better in form than what it currently is. And it is their belief that if you specifically mention e-communication, now granted we're talking about governments who trample on rights to begin with, if you specifically state e-communications, they can't say, well, it doesn't say in the Constitution that you have the right to send your electronic data into a cloud that is owned by anybody else. So we have the right as law enforcement to go in there to get that public information because it's not in your computer, it's not in your phone, it's not in your space. It's being hosted or it's being served by some other entity out there. And law enforcement and the court system seems to believe that those issues, once you do that, that information is no longer yours. So the committee looked at this as a means to clarify that whether it's in a cloud, whether it's on a computer, whether you're sending it via email or whether you're sending it via phone or whether you're sending it whatever, this specifically clarifies to the court system and to law enforcement that anything that is generated out of my electronic space, even if it is a computer in the library, that is my personal property, and you must have a search warrant in order to get it.
Okay. Because we physically receive an tangible possession.
Yeah, because I honestly believe the case would be made, like, if you were down at the library or if you were somewhere else and not using your own computer, they would say, well, that's not your personal equipment. Ergo, anything that you sent out is public. It's no longer private.
So, and intellect, you can't make the case for intellectual property. But, I mean, that's pretty strong. The intellectual property, you know, that's yours.
Yes.
But because you're
I actually agreed with you, but the legislative committee, we went through this for about 10, 15, 20 minutes. We didn't take any of these constitutional amendments lightly. We dug into them deeply. And on this one, they came up and I still think that my email communication should be protected as my own private affairs. But I also, in looking at how government operates, know for a positive fact that they will find a loophole somewhere and say, well, just because you were at the library, that means it's no longer yours. And hopefully there's a chance, I doubt it, that the fact that it specifically states in the constitutional amendment that e-communications are covered as part of our own private data, that perhaps they may think twice before they just start commandeering all this stuff.
Hmm. Okay. I can see the argument on both sides. I mean, I actually can. Since, you know, I'm sure the founding fathers never conceived of e-communications when they were writing the Constitution. So I guess I can go there for that. Do you see anything in this bill language that could come back and bite us in the butt later on?
Because it's so narrowly defined as e-communications, now a lot of people say, well, the Supreme Court already took care of that. Well, actually, no, they didn't. The Supreme Court ruled on cell phones and cell phones only.
Okay.
So the fact that the Supreme Court said that you can't get into somebody's data that's on their cell phone, well, that's a protection right there, but they didn't say anything about a computer that's laying on the seat of the car.
Right,
or
an iPad.
You know, some iPad or any of these other electronic devices. And, you know, I think I'm willing on this one to take that gamble. Because the fact that to amend something means that you clarify it or to make it better, I think the e-communications portion of this actually does clarify a portion of our data that should not be looked at, that our founding fathers would have never, ever, ever, ever guessed would have ever existed.
So that does open the door now for further manipulation of the Constitution on a state and a federal level because of definition. So anything it's going to require fine tuning, I think, which makes me sad. You know, any devices that are invented now and in the next 2 or 3 years, which you know is going to happen, or any storage units or anything like that, is going to be challenged. Instead of being as broad or as all-encompassing is something like the Second Amendment, where it says, you know, shall not be infringed. They're not doing that here. They're specifically targeting electronic communications and data.
Yeah, and so, until we get something else besides what's considered e-communication, I mean, I don't know what it would be.
Yeah, well, none of us does at this point. But it will change because, you know, the technology is changing every day. In 5 years, we'll have, you know, completely different devices and situations we didn't think that we were going to have 5 years ago.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. All right, Tom. No on everything except the last one. No on all of the others. Yes on 9. No on 8, 7, 5, and 1. Yes on 9. We got it covered?
That's the way the Legislative Committee and the Lock and Smith Foundation sees it.
Okay, we just have a minute left. So can you give us any hints? I know you guys have been working feverishly. The legislative session is open. Give us any hints when you're going to unveil your new Locke and Smith recipients this year?
I don't have a top five finalist, but I can pretty much predict that at least three of the five from last year in the House will be finalists.
Okay.
Again, and I'm going to say probably two, possibly three in the Senate from last year will be finalists again this year.
And will you plan to just spill the beans?
Well, I looked last night, because I looked this evening, because that's what we were doing before I got on the phone, was scoring legislation, and we still have over 100 House bills to score the voting records, and probably 200 Senate bills to score. Senate's a lot easier because there's only 34 people.
Okay.
The House is the pain because there's 163 people.
Right.
And to make sure that we don't screw up anywhere, we do our due diligence to make sure that if they're absent, they're marked as absent. If they scored a point, we make sure that they scored a point. If they're not going to score any, we make sure. It's a tedious process, but I don't want to have to go back through and do it again and again and again and again.
There you go. Okay.
So I would say by the end of August, we'll make the top five announcements.
Okay. And when will the unveiling be?
We'd like to do it like we did last year, where we come up to Jefferson City for the Consent of the Governed rally and hand out the plaques then.
Okay, very good. That's always a great deal to unveil that. And actually, you hear a lot of hubbub for and against the lock and fix and not constitutional kind of stuff. But all the legislators want to be recognized by.
Oh, well, we had Will Krause on our local radio station last Friday on our local radio show that we do every Friday morning, and he's elated that he's got two of these plaques, and he's gunning for a third one.
All right.
That's the best thing that we can hear.
Good. I come in the camera with us to post these results on the web page and on the Facebook page, and we'll keep it and let us know how things are going.
All righty. Thank you very much. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks.
You bet.
LockandFoundation.com. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Yankee Doodle came to town riding on a pony. Put a feather in his hat and called it macaroni.
We are running out of time, and run to the very end of the show. Thank John Dollarhite and the Lucases and Tom Martz of the Foundation. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and call us on Facebook and Twitter. All the stories here that we talked to, tonight, along with the Save Our Children Grave Fund, and we will be here next Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. Stand time, Lisa Pager, Missouri Grassroots Coalition.
Missouri Grassroots Radio is brought to you by the Missouri Grassroots Coalition, a cooperative of independent Missouri groups whose aim is to restore constitutional government. Visit us at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter. You can contact us anytime at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. God bless and keep you till next time we meet.